Would you like to reach our film and TV review podcast audience? Do you have a product or service of interest to film and TV home consumers or followers of the entertainment industry? Have a film or show production to publicize? For affordable price plans for all budgets, get in touch and find out about our introductory advertising options. Reach our audience of film and TV viewers and visit our site contact page at filmandtvreview.com, or you can email us at business@filmandtvreview.com. Reach out today. Welcome to filmandtvreview.com. Catch the latest film, TV, and streamed show reviews every week. The views and opinions expressed by the authors and those providing comments are theirs alone. They do not reflect the views, opinions or position of filmandtvreview.com or their respective parent companies or affiliates. Filmandtvreview.com makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, suitability, or validity of any information in this program and is for entertainment purposes only. Episodes may contain adult humor and language. For full terms and conditions, see filmandtvreview.com.
Hello there, and welcome to another edition of Film and TV Review, where we'll look at the offerings of the last month across film and TV. And to kick off January, we had quite a lot of releases over the festive period as well. I'm joined by our regular hosts, Richard, James, Andrew, and Alfonso, possibly. But let's start off with a big Oscar contender, I suppose, or favourite for sure, certainly a BAFTA one anyway, was Hamnet, which is kicking off a historical drama about William Shakespeare and his wife Agnes grieving over their 11-year-old son over a plague-filled Stratford, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal. High praise for this indeed across the board, everyone who's seen it. I think dealing with themes of loss and grieving and kind of a historical context, based on a very successful book. And I think all of you, I think, here has seen it. So who would like to give us their opinion? Richard, you saw this. Let's start with you. Believe the hype of the word of mouth has been very good on this.
Yeah, well, the word of mouth has been amazing. But, and also, actually, I went to see it because I heard about the... not only the Oscar buzz, but the award season buzz, shall we say. I obviously kind of knew what would be about, but I really thought actually that it was, at first, I thought it was a fiction inspired by Hamlet. And after 5 minutes, I understand actually that it was kind of the point of view of Shakespeare's lover, wife, etc., and more of a life than anything else. And it's an interesting movie. Do you want me to go through quickly the synopsis? Or
Just a little bit of
why I say it's interesting is because the movie. I think that actually Shakespeare's name is never mentioned in the movie, if I'm not mistaken, which is kind of funny. I try actually to notice that. I think he never mentioned the word. It's just a story of a guy in the countryside in Great Britain who actually is a tutor of some children and falls in love with a girl who they call him a girl from the forest or whatever. And that's kind of it. And at first, and the thing is that they fall in love with each other, they start to have a family, and he has aspirations. He wants to go to the big city of London to try to write plays and things like that. So and that's kind of it. I would not say more. But yeah, it's funny actually, but how it, I said it, how it is written, this movie, but actually, yeah, it's in a way, it's a fiction about Shakespeare. It made me think about Shakespeare in Love, but not in the, it's definitely different, but Shakespeare in Love from 20 years ago or so, 25 years ago, but in a very much better way. And the strength of the movie are definitely the performances of especially the main actress, Jessie Buckley, but also someone who I actually wasn't a big fan of in the past, Paul Mescal. I'm saying I was being a fan because the only movie that I saw him before was in Gladiator 2, and that was a terrible movie. So, but to be fair, he's definitely better in this one. Surprisingly, he's not been nominated at the Oscars. No idea why, to be honest. But yeah, no, there are some powerful scenes, extremely powerful scenes, especially, not spoilers, obviously, especially the last 15, 20 minutes. But there is also a scene at the middle of the movie that's quite extraordinary. I think there was a huge silence in the movie theater, but as a very good sign, everybody was shocked, to be honest, a couple of times in the movie theater when I was watching it. And you also see the blueprint in a way of Chloé Zhao directing in this movie. It's definitely not a very great pacing, but at least it takes time all the time actually to not only to develop the characters but also actually to have really nice shots of say, well, I was about to say something stupid, but big shot of the na of nature, of the forest, etc. I really like that these parts, taking the time of before going back actually to more drama, let's say. Chloé Zhao, who is actually perhaps going to be actually again rewarded because she won also for Nomadland and she was directing my favorite MCU movie. So yeah, no, it's not a perfect movie because I believe that I believe that actually that it would be better, funny enough, as a play and not as a movie itself. Perhaps it's a bit too long, but the performances and the direction definitely make it, yeah, one of the best movie I've seen so far this year. But it's only February, so.
James, you share those praises.
Yeah, I really like the film. I don't know if it would work as a play actually, because I think a play about a play at the end
Yeah,
might
I know
be really
it's me.
confusing.
It'd
But
be a mise en abyme, but you know,
yeah,
it's because there's some. I don't know. Go ahead.
but I mean, I really liked it. I think the cinematography is absolutely fantastic all the way through it. So when you've got those shots of the forest and things, it just looks beautiful. And actually, that the pacing's very slow, but I think it's a good pacing, if you know what I mean. It's kind of just like that. It's a kind of a slow burn film. So yeah, at the start it seems to be like a love story between this couple that meet in Agnes Hathaway, as she's called apparently in the book and the film, because her real name was Anne, and to they wanted to minimize the confusion with the real life actress Anne Hathaway, so she's called Agnes here. Jessie Buckley absolutely terrific in this role. But yeah, what you when you get the sort of stuff with Hamnet and his kind of the stuff that comes around him, I'm not sure whether we're allowed to spoil it or not, because it's, I mean,
Yeah, no,
it's
because
in the
yeah,
trailer
exactly.
and it's historically known. But there's kind of an element, I think, in the film where the love story is obviously tainted by what they go through, what happens to their children. And there's sort of these key scenes, I think, where Jessie Buckley's saying, but you don't seem to be grieving. And the way that he grieves is to put his grief into the play. And this is kind of a fact in the sense of fan fiction, but there could be truth in it. And it does sort of ring emotionally true that he would maybe put that stuff into it. There's theories as to how direct that influence is, and things. But the final scene, I think it, I mean, it really got me, and it either gets you or it doesn't. I know some people have been particular about the piece of music. So the piece of music is apparently overused in a lot of stuff. I don't know it, so
Yes,
it didn't really.
it's Max Richter from who did the Leftovers theme as well. Very good composer.
There's a big list of stuff. It's been used in EastEnders over here, and it's used a lot. But for me, it was just more that it kind of got me, and it's very difficult to talk about it without ruining the ending. But I think it is about how writers kind of put their emotions into that and let other people uncover them. And yeah, I thought it was phenomenal. The child actor, I think, is Noah Jupe, and actually his brother then plays Hamlet in the play at the end in the Shakespeare Globe. So that's his real life brother playing him in there. But yeah, I thought it was really good. I think Jesse Buckley, looking at the contenders of who's been nominated for leading actress, I think she sh if there's any justice, she will walk that. She will be the winner of that award. I've got to say, I don't think it is Paul Mescal's best performance. It's better than Gladiator 2. I would say try and maybe don't judge him by Gladiator 2 or anybody, Ridley Scott, anybody, Denzel Washington, you know. But I mean, he's fantastic in After Sun, which is probably still his best role, I think. But he's done some really great stuff. But I think this is more her film than his. But yeah, I really liked it. I've been reluctant to go and rewatch it, so I do go and rewatch a lot of stuff. But I kind of feel like if it doesn't hit me emotionally the second time, I might retroactively not enjoy it. I might sort of mark it down and go, "I wasn't as good as I remember." But maybe I will get around to rewatching.
Well, Andrew, what did you think? Didn't really get that many Oscar nominations. More kind of a split between British, where we're focusing awards, and where the Americans are with the Oscars. But how did you find it?
Yes, I really liked it. I actually thought it was one of the, well, sorry, one of the better films this year, and maybe possibly the best. I mean, I know a lot of people are picking, they're focused on one battle after another, and it's understandable given what that film's about and what things are going on in real life. But I guess this movie, Hamnet, really was tugs at the emotional, I guess, heartstrings, as you would say, just about grief and loss and the performances in the film, not just from Jesse Buckley, but everyone else, and just being really vested in the story. Just a little bit of other information based on the novel. So novel because not everything in the film is quite accurate historically, because people don't necessarily know about Agnes, she's called in the film, Anne Hathaway. They don't know as much about her life. So there's a lot of speculation just with regards to things in the film. I mean, things could have happened a certain way, but they don't know that for sure. So for historical purposes, it's not all accurate. And that's why they say it's a novel, and this movie is based on that novel as opposed to a nonfiction book. So as far as everyone else in the film, you mentioned Paul Mescal. He's done a lot of great stuff. He was actually nominated for After Sun. Kind of interesting, he was nominated for that and wasn't nominated for this, but that's a whole other thing. And Joe Alwyn is playing the brother of Jesse Buckley's character, and also Emily Watson playing the matriarch of the Shakespeare family. So a pretty good cast throughout. And as I said, really liked it. And you'll see how it does, with the upcoming awards.
Sure. And Alfonso, you saw Hamnet as well. Did you is it worth the praise or one of those mixed
Well, I
opinion?
mean,
But
expectations are maybe sometimes work against the picture, and in this case, my expectations were high of what I was gonna encounter, and maybe I was a little bit disappointed, not too much, but I guess this seems like, let's say, an Oscar front runner, along with One Battle After Another, for example. And it, well, I enjoy, well, I don't know how, if enjoyed is the right word, but I appreciated it. And I thought that the actors were really good. And it was, it, at the end, well, it was sort of a catharsis also. It kind of worked as a catharsis of, like, it's a sad story, and it's like a little bit meta, because it talks about a sort of catharsis, and it the movie itself is also a catharsis for the viewer at the end. So I mean, it's a very good film, but maybe I was expecting quite a lot. I don't know, like a mixed bag, I guess.
okay, well, we'll see in the award ceremony where it goes and where it lands. Right, next. A part of, I guess, a franchise, I suppose. Now it's of the 28 years later, the Bone Temple, the I guess a very long running franchise, I suppose, of the post-apocalyptic horror sequel following the survivors of a zombie apocalypse, which is obviously was the flavor of a few, well, the last few years anyway. Here, so it's a kind of difficult one to kind of like reinvent, but it was the guy who started it all, was like Danny Boyle in all those years ago. So it was interesting to see what fresh meat could be picked from the bones of this franchise. It kind of follows a sadistic cult involving I suppose an alpha male and a kind of like it's set in a small isolated little village, and then you meet a few characters along the way. A good cast in here. Ralph Fiennes is in this as a kind of a strange character as well. I was not a fan of the old big zombie thing, but I did give this a viewing, and so far I've seen most of it, and it is very well put together, very 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 well directed. James, you are a quite a fan of this genre, and this film,
Yes.
I
Well,
kind of liked it so far. But how did you find this entry?
yeah, I'm not the biggest zombie fan. I'm sort of as big a fan as anybody else, really. Enjoy The Walking Dead, lot of respect for Dawn of the Dead and Shaun of the Dead. Really like 28 Days Later, which is obviously, many years ago now, and was all sort of filmed, one of the first films shot on digital, shot sort of very guerrilla style in the middle of London to get all those shots in the early hours of the day. There was a sequel 28 weeks later, which you can kind of forget about that one. And then last year we had 28 years later from Danny Boyle, all the scripts by Alex Garland of Civil War and Ex Machina and all that kind of stuff. And the first film was sort of about family and about death, I think, which sounds like it's a zombie film, so obviously it would be, but it's maybe about that first one's maybe about death in a way that you wouldn't expect. And they say this one's about evil, which it is. And I'll sort of set up the plot without ruining anything that you. It's difficult at this point to not give away the end of 28 years later, but I can sort of not talk about some of the detail of it. So there's a young kid called Spike. His parents aren't around for reasons that might not be what you would expect from the first film. Go and watch that one. But he is now part of Jack O'Connell's sort of cult that he's hanging about with. So they save him at the end, at the very end of the first film. And now he's into this sort of gang. And they are not nice people. To be honest, this is one of those films where the zombies are horrible, but some of the people involved are even worse.
Worse.
And this one is rated 18 for sort of more sadistic person-on-person violence rather than zombie blood, which is sort of often containable at 15 in the UK. So you have sort of two stories running parallel, which is Spike being part of this gang with Jack O'Connell's Sir Jimmy Crystal, so Lord Jimmy Crystal. And in the meantime, you also have Dr. Ian Kelson, played by Ralph Fiennes, brilliantly played by Ralph Fiennes, from the previous movie, who is continuing his work of just sort of basically he's disposing of the dead in like a clean way to minimize infection and things like that. But there's also a point in the previous film where he's sedating some of the zombies rather than killing them. And there's a story in this involving the alpha zombie called Samson, who is absolutely terrifying, rips people's heads clean from their bodies with spines still attached. And it sounds ridiculous, but this film kind of looks at an unlikely bromance between Ian Kelson's character and Samson. But what I think is really clever is, whereas that might sound like, oh, it might sound a bit naff, they do a really good job of alternating the light and shade in this film. So there's a very key moment involving Samson, which is bookended by two of the worst bits of violence in the film, most horrific bits of violence. Jack O'Connell's gang give chat what they call charity to people that they prey upon and steal their riches, basically, and indeed their lives. Nia DaCosta has taken over directing duties here. The needle drops in it. I mean, if you haven't got to the end, Jason, you're missing so much, but the needle drops in here are perfect. There's like five, really, or six, actually, because I don't want to spoil, but there's kind of six, I suppose. The use of a Duran Duran song very early on is absolutely brilliant. And again, at the point that it might sound naff, they do something with the sound where they make it, they kind of twist the sound and it sounds really eerie. And it's like the perfect choice, really. There's this line that he that recurs about that there's nothing wrong with respite, nothing wrong with peace and respite. And I think it's so good, this movie. It's so, like, I was really, I kind of thought it's a lot less experimental than Danny Boyle's style, but actually Nia DaCosta's style probably suits the story more. So, and it's definitely scarier. There's moments that really made me jump the first time. The sound design is amazing. Ralph Fiennes, Jack O'Connell, are amazing, but so is Erin Kellyman, who plays Jimmy Ink, one of the gang members, and Chi Lewis Perry, who plays Samson. Yeah, it's kind of my favorite film of the year at the moment. But like you say, we're only in February. But and it ends with one of the things about 28 years later is nobody understood the ending. So everybody said, why does that happen at the end? Well, it happened because it's setting up this film. And now actually I've spoken to a lot of people that said, oh, okay, that's fine. I didn't realize there was another film and it makes sense now. Clearly at the end of this film, you know what's gonna the final scene is kind of this will be what happens in part three, and part three's been greenlit now, even though the box office hasn't been fantastic. Obviously, it's a bit more of a restrictive certificate in the UK because it's an 18. But apparently they're due to film that in the summer because obviously they need to film these when there's a lot of daylight to get the early morning shots and things. But yeah, I really liked it. And I think I'll just say as well, although they are zombie films, they're kind of stories set in a zombie world. So in a sense, in this, there's definitely enough zombie action for everyone. But I feel like there's something else going on in these films. They're kind of about people trying to live whilst that's going on outside. And maybe the best zombie stuff, that's what it is. You know, Walking Dead's like that and Dawn of the Dead's like that a little bit. But, you know, I think this is really like a really good story that's set in the backdrop of a zombie apocalypse. And it's sort of like nothing else you've ever seen before. And also, there is something with the violence that maybe you don't see as much as you think. When I've rewatched it, it's sort of the idea of what's happening is worse than what you see. I mean, you do see the aftermath of a lot of stuff in this, but I think it's a bit like with the Human Centipede, right? If you know what that film is about, you go, it's the point when you realize what it's about, you go, oh my God, that's disgusting. But actually in the film, everything is kind of quite restrained in what it shows you. It's leaving more to the imagination than maybe you think, but there's some still really tough sort of torture scenes and things. But yeah, I think it's great. It's a good mix of horror and beauty.
Yeah, it's absolutely shot. Alfonso, you saw this. It's yeah, it's I was quite pleased with it, how it's so far what I've seen. But you've been a fan of this franchise for a while, or are
I
zombies your
liked
bag?
the previous one very much. I very much enjoyed 28 years later. This one I liked it less because it kind of changes a little bit the story in to focus more on, like, well, what James said. I felt it more like a side quest in a sense, of how this I thought the story was gonna go and how what the relevancy of like the zombie or infected were had in, they had they were kind of like sidestep or side, not really given the focus here to and yes what James said that the focus was really on the this kind of like blonde group kind of a Clockwork Orange kind of gang. So I really thought it was gonna be more a little bit more like the previous one with the more like of the infected being like ch chasing people and all these things, and then you have like storyline of Samson being domesticated or something or kind of humanized, and at the same time the humans are the real danger here. So I mean, not what I was expecting, and not what I wanted, baby. I mean, baby, not baby, but like not what I really wanted from this franchise. I think in the third one of this trilogy, they will come back to the infected, probably, and this will be a movie that you can enjoy it or not, but it's not so important for the whole trilogy.
Maybe. Maybe more for the evolution of Spike, the protagonist, but yeah, anyway.
Okay. And last, Andrew, if you somewhere in the middle, I mean, both sides, some
Well,
prefer this one or.
yeah, I mean, I would say I liked it a little bit better than the previous film only because tonally was more consistent. Like the previous film had some good moments and then some moments that were just sort of like, what's going on here? And then you get to the ending of the previous film and it feels like some other film altogether. And here was more consistent. And, at the end of the previous film, it's a little bit campy and these characters come across as really campy. And here you see them more as the threat that you would imagine them to be, especially given who they're dressed up as. On that note, the outfits, it's a combination of, they dress up as Jimmy Savile, but also as the Teletubbies, because I guess the person who leads them was a fan of the Teletubbies before things went down. You see them as a threat through this film. The acting you guys mentioned was good. Also, I'd like to mention Chai Lewis Perry, I guess if that's how you pronounce his name, the one who plays Samson. You actually see him act a little bit here too, not just as, oh, okay, the brute, the alpha, whatever. He still does that, but also he does show some acting chops here as well because of reasons that you find out about in this film. And you talk about the music, there's a lot of 80s music in the film. There's songs from Duran Duran. There's also another song by another group that appears during the climax. It's been advertised a lot in the posters, but I won't say much more about that here. Just to also clarify, this is not quite a zombie apocalypse because it's only the island of Great Britain that's affected. I say Great Britain and not the UK because you never mention Northern Ireland, but that's probably for someone else to address. I'm not going to bring that up myself any more than
So
ever.
people are not living in the UK in this franchise. They really like where they live.
Island of Great Britain. It's quarantined.
We're
Oh, it's
quarantined,
quarantined. They
yeah.
cannot leave. Okay.
They can't leave that specific island. So, and Northern Ireland's on a different island. So, but yeah, I mean, there's the character from Sweden, and then there's something that happens here in
Oh,
this film.
yeah.
So you kind of like it brings up other issues, but yeah, it's basically just this one island that's quarantined. The rest of the world, more or less, is okay. I mean, I'm not going to go into all the details of the previous films and all the issues that would bring up, but I'll just say that I generally like this film. I thought it was a bit better than the previous film, totally consistent and just well done. And hopefully the director, Nia DaCosta, hopefully she'll, I know people kind of were hard on her because of what was it, the Marvels and how that did. And also, as far as The Walking Dead, I don't know if you're comparing The Walking Dead because of the whole waking up in hospital thing, but that actually started decades earlier with something called Day of the Triffids. So,
It's not, not my, my, I mentioned that because I think I mentioned that already when the previous movie was released. I think that the first movie from the early 2000s with Cillian Murphy was very good, etc. In a way, it might actually have started this for this new generation, started a new revival of zombie movies in a way, or with the Zack Snyder movie, etc. Because obviously, yeah, decades ago, there were already movies and movies about zombies. My point is that this is not a problem. It's not because of this franchise or because of Danny Boyle. It's something that we discussed before, is the advantages of a TV show and the fact that Walking Dead had 11 years and 200 episodes or whatever to actually to deal with zombies and live and finding out that the monsters in the zombie world is actually the human beings, and you have to deal with how people behave to each other in a post-apocalyptic, sorry, world, etc. All these themes and topics, etc., have been dealt with in Walking Dead through seasons after seasons in the last 11 years, or in the last 15 years or so. Sometimes good way, bad way, it can be debated. But in my opinion, yeah, there is nothing new that this franchise is bringing. I haven't seen Bone Temple, to be fair, it's true. But even the previous movie, I was thinking, what does it bring to the table, this movie? And I didn't see anything that it was bringing. But that's what
I
that's
think
what I'm saying. In regards to more of the debates that it talks about living in this kind of world and how the relationship between humans are, etc.
It
Walking Dead is a
brings,
great job about this.
I think
it
the
brings a humongous penis. That brings
Sorry?
a humongous penis.
Do you know what, though? I think for this film, it obviously it does appeal to people internationally, but I think for a UK audience, there are things that it's talking about that are very relevant to today's society in Britain. So I think the first film particularly is talking about sort of the death of culture and the rise of kind of the right. And there's a particular line at the end that gets a bit of a laugh in the cinema. I won't ruin it because Jason's here, but there is a line about fascism at the end, and how sort of remembering the First World War is so that things don't return and we never repeat those mistakes. And it's funny that I've seen it a few times and everybody laughs at that line, because it's like, in this world they're remembering that, in our world that seems to have been forgotten slightly. And obviously the stuff about Savile, which is kind of, I mean, his name is never mentioned in the film actually, but very clearly from that look, like anybody watching that in the UK knows what that look is, and that kind of thing of false prophets and maybe looking up to the wrong people and things like that. But there's a lot of stuff in the first film where there's a sort of a distrust of science as well, and there's a sort of that the kind of reaction that Aaron Taylor-Johnson's character has to Ian Kelson, and that he's very suspicious of him. He doesn't understand why he's burning these bodies. He thinks he's a freak. And it's quite, there's kind of a lot of stuff like that that's going on in it. But I think, but I mean, obviously The Walking Dead ran for years, but and zombie films aren't new, and obviously we had this
It
explosion
doesn't
of
mean
them
that
years.
it doesn't mean I'm saying not saying that Walking Dead was perfection all the way, huh? There were some high and lows, but obviously with 200 hours of TV show, you have much more time actually to literally talk and describe what this world and this new society would look like, etc., than actually a movie that has only 2 hours to do it. And yeah, these topics that you mentioned now and the topics that I've seen in the previous movie, all these things, I've seen it in The Walking Dead, and they were doing very well with great acting and great writing. So that's what I'm saying. What can I expect more in the movie about that kind of thing, about the zombie world nowadays? I don't think I will see more, but maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know.
Well, I think what makes this unique is the idea that it's only affecting this one island. The rest of the world is continuing as normal. So that's kind of an element, and they may explore that in the next film too. I don't know yet. So,
I think
but.
there's definitely a Brexit analogy to be made there, isn't there? You know, the kind of, Europe is doing okay and we're kind of isolated. So that's definitely in there.
Okay. Well, from one post apocalyptic franchise to another, in case you hadn't had enough, it's Fallout Season 2 here. Of course, based on the game, but again, it's the same kind of like a post-nuclear event, as societies have existed underground in vaults. And I think we've had the Season 2, which did really quite well. A very good, actually one of the few good adaptations from a game, a IP. Following the characters of Lucy and the immortal gunslinger, the Ghoul, played by some very good cast, I mean, Ella Purnell, Walton Goggins, and Kyle MacLachlan. And it kind of like moves between their lives before and their lives now in this strange mixture of sci-fi, Western, kind of new post-apocalyptic landscape. I enjoyed season one. Season two, I haven't had the motivation to actually see it. But Andrew, you've seen this. What am I missing out on season two of Fallout?
Well, just trying to get some summation because, yeah, this is part of a whole franchise, and obviously, the ideas come from the games, but it's not a direct adaptation of the games because it's more like a series of stories of characters who exist within the world that the games exist. So it's part of the same franchise, but it's not like, The Last of Us, where, here's the storyline, and we're just adapting that for the series. So you have a bunch of new characters who were introduced last year and some who were introduced this year, but they exist in the world of the games. And there's very much a sense of people who play the games, they'll be like, oh, they'll recognize something, or they'll be like, yep, that's that place or that person. So, I mean, you don't have to play the games to really watch the show, but I have a feeling that people who play the games will get a lot more out of it. Anyway, on that note, just give a brief idea. The first season, you're introduced to some characters in this post-apocalyptic world. There is a character named Lucy McLean, and her father gets kidnapped by some people, and then she finds out her father wasn't all that she thought he was. And so the story kind of picks up from that. There's another character called the, well, he's referred to as the ghoul because he's very ghoulish in his appearance, and he's, that's what they call these post-apocalyptic mutants. And it's played by Walton Goggins. And basically, you have his character is kind of like a bounty hunter. And so he's kind of got his own little agenda going on that you find out about it as the series progresses. And then there's another character. I'm just going to focus on the three main ones called Maximus. And he's part of this group called the Brotherhood. And they're trying to bring civilization to this post-apocalyptic wasteland, or simply called the Wasteland. So season two kind of picks up on their stories, but because there's a lot more stories in season two, this, it seems like the pacing is, it's not necessarily anything wrong with it. It's just because you're kind of trying to focus on all these different stories. And so you have like this episode here where they're focusing on these characters, and that episode you focus on this group of characters, and then it kind of switches. And the sense I get is that they're trying to build for a multi-season arc. So this season, season two, is just part of that. So you can enjoy it while watching it, but you also may feel like, well, maybe I should wait till the show ends and then I'll just watch all the seasons back. Because I think they want to, the showrunners want to go for like maybe five seasons. I don't know what they've announced, maybe it's six, but whatever the ratings are or whatever the metrics are for streaming. So, now, in addition to all the stuff that's going on in the then present of this post-apocalyptic world, you have a lot of flashbacks to what life was like just before things went down, and you focus on Goggins's character before he became this mutant post-apocalyptic. He was an actor named Coop or Cooper Howard, known for doing westerns. And just a little bit of brief context. This whole thing takes place in this alternate timeline where things were kind of in a retro futuristic kind of way. So, whatever the 50s, 1950s version was of the future, it was kind of like that before the apocalypse happened. And so, there were all these wars over resources, and it led to a nuclear conflict. So, you're led to believe. And yeah, and so you find out certain things about. You know, who's kind of running things, you know, sort of like you see in other video games, like there's like this evil corporation, and you know, there's maybe this other evil, you know, all these corporations, and you know, who's kind of really running things, and this idea of a conspiracy. So, just focusing on this particular season, it was pretty good, but I do kind of feel like you maybe should look at it as part of like a part of a whole rather than the entirety, like you know, some shows it's like, you know, this is this season, this is what happens here, and then you move to the next season, this is what happens here, and here it's like one part of a larger story arc, as I said. So and also on the show as a key factor is Kyle MacLachlan's character. He plays the father of Lucy. She's played by Elle Purnell. So and then also on the show, you have Maximus played by Aaron Moten. And then also a lot was made the season of Macaulay Culkin's joining the cast. He doesn't appear that much, but you kind of get a sense of, you know, he's going to be more important down the line, so to speak. So, but I do remember there was like a whole lot about him joining the cast. It was like, oh, okay. And then also Justin Theroux, he plays a canon character. From the games, so he's pretty good when you do see him. So yeah, it's good by itself, but I think it's maybe better to just kind of see it as part of however long the season arcs or how many seasons they do. So that's just my impression.
I think I think it will turn into a very binge-worthy kind of series. Because season one, I think everyone was it was just very watchable and almost had this semi conclusion. But then here it seems like what more have we got to tell? But it seems it is a whole vast world to explore in there. So yeah, maybe a bit later to put a pin on it and binge later on. But its production values, everything, performances, it's all great there actually. I mean, it's can't say it's a bad series. Right. Next, I think I first have one of a sporting biopic, especially in the UK. It's Giant. This is kind of telling the story of Prince Nazim. I think a boxing biopic in based in Sheffield. Is started as an underdog, but then I think rise to basically a world title superstardom. Starring Emile El Masri and Pierce Brosnan as his coach, I think, who kind of semi-discovered him, and then in his formative part of his career was quite supportive. Looked quite intriguing and quite a character back in the day in the UK. James, you did see this. Interesting, a lot of stuff to delve into there. Is it a good biopic? It's an interesting enough story, surely. You're on mute, of course.
Apologies. Yeah, like you say, Prince Nassim, massive sort of personality in the UK. In terms of his personality, not massive in his physicality, and that was one of the unique things about him, really, that he was quite a small guy, but he would sort of put his whole body weight behind a punch, like an uppercut, and he would sort of dance around the ring and sort of taunt his opponents. And there was definitely a showmanship coming into to boxing there. And it's also like in mid-90s was the start of like pay-per-view in the UK, because obviously that was a thing in the US for a while, but it's sort of come to the UK. The Tyson Bruno fight was, or rematch, was one of the first ones of those. But actually, this is more a biopic about Brendan Ingle, who was his trainer, and I think it is actually based on a book that was written about Brendan Ingle, who passed away a couple of years ago. And obviously, if you've got Pierce Brosnan in the film, he's going to take up a lot of the screen time, but he probably gets more screen time than Prince Nassim. It's perfectly functional biopic, and that sounds like damning with faint praise. But I mean, it's enjoyable, but it's not. I wouldn't say it's remarkable or anything. I think again, if you're in the UK, there's little things that you will admire about the detail of the 90s, whether it's sweet rappers or TV shows that are on, or cars or things. It's got a lot of sort of very specific nostalgia for the mid 90s, if you kind of remember that and the detail of it. I really like the ending, the way that they do the ending, and obviously I'm not going to ruin what that is, but I thought it was a really unique way of kind of showing where these characters' lives sort of finally intersected or didn't intersect, as they kind of start to fall out over the years. So Brian Engel trained Prince Nassim from a very young age, but as he got older and more of a star, he questioned more whether Brendan had his interests at heart or if he was a sort of just there for as a financial gain for him and things like that. So the film looks at that stuff. But yeah, it's perfectly fine. Sylvester Stallone is billed as an executive producer on this, and it just feels like they've sort of gone to him and said, "Can you put your name on this because you did Rocky?" You know, it doesn't feel like it's. And I mean, the fight scenes in it are nothing remarkable. They're not like the sort of one shot that you get in Creed or anything like that. But if you're interested in the subject, it's perfectly worth a watch.
Okay. Right. Next, another kind of sporting movie, biopic almost, but is Marty Supreme. It is basically with let me see. It's kind of 1950s sports, I guess, dramedy. It's kind of a hustler turn table tennis star with Timothée Chalamet as the title role. I haven't. There's some interesting comments on that, and some loved it. But who saw this? This was well, again, I guess James, you saw this as well. As in, is this a better one? As in, kind of a sporting
Oh yeah, oh,
biopic?
but is it better than Giant? Yeah, 100%. Why did we do Giant first? I mean, it's funny because yeah, it's a mash of loads of stuff. I mean, just saying it's a drama, I think, is fine. But I never thought of it as a dramedy. I mean, there's bits in it that made me laugh. But it's very well acted. I think obviously Timothée Chalamet, but the is it Adessa Azan, who plays his sort of girlfriend in this. I think it's absolutely phenomenal in this movie. She's so good. But yeah, it is set in the 1950s. It's sort of a fictional character, but it's loosely based on somebody else, I believe. And Gwyneth Paltrow is great in this. I like how it's set in the 50s, but there is 80s music in it. And it's not just because I'm a child of the 80s and I like 80s music. There's sort of a lot of use of Tears for Fears and stuff. And it just sort of works in the context of the film. I'd say as well, there's like a every half an hour, every 20 minutes, half an hour, there's like a WTF moment. And so there's a moment involving a bath, and there's a moment involving a car, and there's a moment involving trousers, and there's just bits that make you go, what? It sort of made me think of, in Pulp Fiction, where and apologies for the spoiler for a 32-year-old film, but the moment where Marvin gets shot in the face, and it just comes out of nowhere, but in the best way, not in a rubbish comes out of nowhere way, like, oh wow, that happens in real life, accidents happen, things go wrong. And there's bits in this where you're just like, oh my God, I won't forget that moment. I really liked it. I know people are talking about this in the same breath as One Battle and Sinners. It's really, really good. I don't like it quite as much as those movies. So actually, I'd seen this after my top 10 of the year, but it came out Boxing Day in the UK. It probably still wouldn't have gone into my top 10, but it would be in like my easily in my top 15, I think. But yeah, I thought it was really, really enjoyable movie. Kind of crazy, and he's maybe one of those classic unlikable protagonists. But by the end of the film, I do kind of like him. He's a bit of a douche in a lot of ways, but I think what he's after in life are completely understandable things. He wants to succeed, he kind of wants the best for himself, and there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe the way he goes about it in certain parts of the film aren't the best, but yeah, it's great when you see a film like this with an unlikable protagonist, but you're still rooting for them. I think that's a real feat of the writing, directing, and the performance.
Okay. Andrew, you saw this as well. It's like the compressing the word of table tennis, but I say it's kind of semi-fictional account of a character in there. Did you enjoy this? Some good word of mouth about this though. It's on my list.
Yeah, it's sort of or like inspired by the real life person Marty Reisman. I mean, it's not quite that story, but I guess that's where the idea came from. So it's a different Marty real life. In the movie, it's Marty Mauser. So anyway, I don't know if I would say I liked it as much as other people. I mean, the look of the film and the acting and all that was fine. I just kind of found myself watching the film and, and it's one half of the Safdie brothers who directed it. I guess it's Josh Safdie. And I know when the two brothers worked together, they would do films where you'd follow a character who wasn't really that likable, but, that was kind of, part of the story. Here you kind of are like, well, you're supposed to root for this character because it starts out kind of like a sports drama type thing and more typical, and then it kind of goes into its own thing. So maybe you're not supposed to, because it seems like a lot of the characters in this film have less than positive qualities, let's just say. So like, it's not like, oh, this person's really great and this other person's like everyone's kind of flawed or everyone's kind of does things that are kind of like a lot of them. You may think, oh, this person seems sympathetic, and then they do something underhanded. So, I guess in this film, because it starts out as this sports drama and this kind of uplifting story, and then it kind of goes into like something else, and then you're like, oh, okay, he does a lot of things to survive this protagonist, and so do some of the other characters. So, and yeah, it does follow some of the more typical sports biopic or sports drama tropes, but it does it in its kind of own way. I guess if you just kind of detach yourself from it and kind of say, well, this is a story and you're not really supposed to root for him in the more typical way, then maybe. I just kind of found like the movie was trying to get you to sympathize or root for him. And, he's not exactly that kind of person. He's at least the protagonist. He's kind of, or really anyone else in this film, they kind of are, not exactly on the up and up. So I mean that's fine in some other films that the two of them Safdie brothers had worked on, but Here it's just one of them. And as I said, it looks fine. Filming, cinematography, the acting, all that's fine. I don't know if I would say I liked it as much as other people did. That's just.
Okay, and I think Alfonso, you saw this as well. Any quick opinion on this as well?
Yeah, but I am in the I loved it camp. I really loved it. I loved it more than About the Laughter and Others, Sinners, Hamlet. I really enjoyed it. It's very enjoyable film. I subscribe what Andrew and James said about the well, unlikable character, but very determined and not so unlikable really. It was well, morally I'm not very like a good person, but with a very clear objective and very a lot of hurdles, obstacles to get there. So the movie, it's always going forward. Things are happening all the time. He's trying to overcome everything and creating, even he creates new obstacles for himself. But he always has the will and the audacity to always try to come up with the next solution that will take him closer to his objective. And I think, I mean, yeah, the movie is very propulsive, and you really, yeah, I really am in the I loved it kind of part of it.
Okay, then. Next, more fictional horror genre here is Primate. It was like a B movie plot, but it's like a it's this island set natural horror where I think a family's adopted chimpanzee goes rabid after a bite, and then it turns onto a I think it's a family on vacation in a and it all turns into a in a A vacation into a bloody siege, I think, terrorized by this chimpanzee. This sounds B movie, but is it fun? Is it good? Alfonso, you did see this. Are you his
Yeah.
biggest fan? Is it fun?
Not very much to me. I mean, I thought it was quite generic. You kind of sum it up perfectly with what you said. It's basically that. It's that doesn't have anything
Dear.
else. It's basically, yeah, a monkey that gets a rabies and goes, well, he kind of loses his mind and attacks everyone. That's it. That's the movie. I mean, I thought it was gonna be something more. But no, it was like a monster in the house movie, typical, but this time with a monkey, with a primate. So
Okay.
nothing else to say. I was quite bored because
Sure.
it was a little bit by the numbers of these kind of films, and boring to me.
Andrew, you saw this? Anything fresh here, or is it as worn out as Alfonso said? Sure.
Well, I'll just give a little context. I guess I'll get to what my issue is with the film in a moment. Basically, in the film, you have these university students who are, I guess, are home on break. They're coming home to Hawaii, the state of Hawaii, and the chimp is basically their late mother, rather the I guess there's like one student who's kind of like the protagonist. So like basically her late mother was like a researcher and worked with I guess animals and taught this chimp sign language or American Sign Language. On that note, the father who's still alive, who's played by Troy Kotsur, if you know from the movie Coda, winning the Oscar. So he's hearing impaired both in the movie and in real life, so he's able to communicate with the chimp because the chimp knows sign language, you know. And then from the late mom who taught the chimp sign language, and I imagine the father did as well. So, and that's sort of like a real life context, you know, that they've worked. Some researchers have actually taught chimps sign language. So this student is home. She's reconnecting with her family, with her sister, her younger sister, and her father, after the mother had passed away sometime not too long before the movie takes place. And then they have the friends who are also home from university. So, and the chimp this has been said, gets rabies and starts to go on a rampage in the house. Yeah, so I mean that's what it is. I think my main issue with the film is it's fine in terms of the horror scenes and all that, and there's some pretty gruesome scenes. I guess Richard's not here, so pretty violent scenes. For those who like that kind of thing, yeah, it delivers. My main issue is that choosing to set the story in Hawaii, and this does get mentioned in the film eventually, but without trying to give too much away. But as with the UK, as I understand it, rabies is not a thing in the state of Hawaii. It's a series of islands, and when you have an island, the disease can't really, travel. That's in real life, and it does get mentioned in the film. But why you would choose Hawaii, a place where rabies doesn't exist, and since that's something that the film touches on a little bit, I thought, well, that could be like an interesting thing in itself, but it doesn't really get addressed that much. I mean, briefly, but I thought, well, that could be like an interesting story in itself. Like, how did this disease get to Hawaii, and what does this mean? It doesn't really get mentioned a whole lot, just briefly. So I kind of like, why couldn't they have said it's somewhere else in the U.S.? And maybe because otherwise, then they would have to, that may affect other issues within the plot line or something. But I just felt like they could have said it somewhere else. Otherwise, it's like, I mean, it looks nice in Hawaii, but I don't think it was actually filmed there. I think it was filmed, the outdoor scenes, I think, were filmed in Portugal, maybe. And the indoor scenes were filmed in the UK. But I don't know why they said in Hawaii, but it looks nice in the scenery. But yeah, that was, I guess, my main issue with the film.
Well, okay. Fine. Well, next, I guess we are in the season of biopics because we next we have Is This Thing On? It's kind of a bittersweet comedy drama about struggling stand-ups, messy life and career and a particular stage of his life based on a John Bishop, who's kind of like a TV regular and just, a stand-up comedian, I think from Liverpool, really, originally. And this has been directed by Bradley Cooper, so it's kind of a transplanted to a US same story, but it is his story. But I was wondering how these things translate. But it's got Will Arnett, Laura Dern, and it is, I think, it came out recently here. James, you saw this. Is this. Does this travel well, this story? Because it is kind of a pretty local story in the UK, but then getting the US treatment.
Surprisingly, it does, and that was my concern about going to see it. Is I thought, well, I know who John Bishop is very well, and obviously he was a companion in Doctor Who briefly as well, for one series, but very well known UK stand-up for maybe the last 15 years, particularly on TV over here. But yeah, it's literally that it's just transported to America, and it works very well. So instead of the comedy story, it would probably be if it was in the UK, although that's not where John Bishop did his first gig. I think it would have been at like a Frog and Bucket in Liverpool or something. So he's it's sort of transported to the comedy cellar, and basically it's yeah the story of a marriage. They got two sort of 10-year-old children. Marriage is breaking down, and one night he just sort of stumbles across a comedy club. And it's an open mic night, and he tries stand up for the first time, and basically because he's got no material, he just starts talking about his life, and then he finds it quite therapeutic and decides to keep going back and to keep going back. And actually, I've seen this twice now, and what I noticed the second time is it's much. There is stuff about comedy in it, and it all seems very, it seems very authentic, and I believe John Bishop had some sort of input into that side of things, but the story about the relationship that's breaking down is really sort of the meat of it, I think, and particularly in the second part. In fact, one of the final scenes on stage that I suddenly thought, oh, I haven't seen him on stage for a long time. But yeah, it's really good. So it's kind of like, I mean, it's a drama really, but it's got funny moments in it, I'd say, rather than a comedy drama. And that works quite well, I think, because it could have been tempting to just make it a comedy. And I think actually that wouldn't have worked. And Will Arnett is really good in here. Laura Dern's always brilliant in everything. But this is one of those films where it's a brilliant dual title. is this thing on? Is what comedians say when nobody's laughing about the microphone. But is this thing on? It's about, is the relationship between Laura Dern and Will Arnett's characters, is it on or off? Because they haven't gone through the final stages of divorce. They're separated and they're trying to work it out. And I think there's some really lovely, touching moments in this. Bradley Cooper also has a cameo as Will Arnett's friend Balls, who is a struggling actor, and he definitely has some of the best lines. It's one of those things where you think the director's just keeping the funniest lines for himself, and he kind of steals the show every time he's in. The only thing I will have a little whinge about on this, right? And we mentioned Aftersun earlier. Under Pressure is used in the trailer, so I think I'm okay to say it because it's not a massive spoiler. But towards the end of the film, they use Under Pressure, which is used brilliantly in Aftersun, and it's used in a particular way where they strip the instruments out and they just leave the vocals. They do that in this. They literally steal that idea, but it doesn't feel earned. In fact, it feels really weird because it's sort of like, why are we listening to this without any music? It doesn't make any sense. But that's one tiny gripe that I've got, that they've kind of, it feels like they've plagiarized that from Aftersun, which did it first. But yeah, I was really surprised. I didn't think this would work at all. But actually, I think it works very, very well.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I did hear out this side story that he, when they approached him, I think Will Arnett really pushed to get this done. And I think before John Bishop agreed to it, he said, okay, I'll let you have a shot at it, but you've got to come over here to Liverpool. And you've got to come and do some stand up yourself. And actually, before you get my
Yes.
story too. So it's
So
quite
I think that this is the thing. He
key
was
to it,
Will
isn't
Arnett
it?
was being introduced as the character because he's not John Bishop in the character is called Alex Novak in this, rather than John Bishop, just to, probably to give a bit of distance between the characters. But apparently, he was introduced at comedy clubs as Alex Novak and went on stage. And obviously, some people recognised him as Will Arnett to try and get that authentic stand-up experience. And it's that thing that stand-up scenes work very well because they're not hilarious, but they're not toe curling either. They're just kind of in the middle, which is what you'd expect it to be. Like if somebody's starting out, they wouldn't be killing it with amazing original material. It's all kind of very kind of basic material, if you like, but in the best possible way. So, and that's where I think the authenticity of the films that the film has for the stand-up scenes comes through.
Okay. Next, we got to another dark comic survival thriller, I suppose, in that territory. Send Help. This is about an employee and a domineering boss stranded on a deserted island after a plane crash. Rachel McAdams and Dylan O'Brien, directed by Sam Raimi. Always a good pedigree of horror, obviously from the Evil Dead series. So, always good stuff when he is in this wheelhouse. So, see, James, you saw this.
Yeah, we've got all the directors from the terrible MCU films today, haven't we? But there you go.
Terrible.
Wow.
What do you
Back to
mean?
their
What do you
roots,
mean
though. They
terrible? What do you mean
work.
terrible?
They.
The two good ones actually in the recent years, actually.
The Doctor Strange fandom fights breaking out here. But yeah, I mean, like, Sam Raimi has his. Despite what the script is, he always has his unique, eye on that, and very stylistic. And he does good work in this. Just give him a good script, and he does some great work. But I'm guessing Send Help, is that kind of like a pretty
It's
good,
really, really good. And I've got to say, I saw the trailer, and I think the trailer is one of those trailers that doesn't really do the film justice and maybe makes it look like a slightly different film to the film it is. Rachel McAdams, who I think is incredible in, it sounds bad to say in the first third of the film, but the physicality of her in the opening, where she is a dowdy, obviously she's a stunningly attractive actress, and she is so dowdy and plays this sort of like crumpled woman at the start who just keeps getting overlooked at work, and speaks to her boss and accidentally has tuna sandwich all down her face and stuff. And it's just such a great performance at the start. And yet they go to this desert island and the tables are turned, much like with Triangle of Sadness. I know when that film come out, I think it won the Palme d'Or a couple of years ago. And I think when we were talking about it, somebody said, oh, it's like an Eat the Rich film. But I think that does a disjustice to that film. It's really about the triangle is that the hierarchy flips. So once they end up on the desert island, suddenly all the people who had power before are the least powerful, and the people that had the skills now have the sort of upper hand. And her boss is injured in the flight, but she's always had this desire to go on a reality show, sort of I'm a celebrity type show, and be like living in the jungle. So she really thrives in this environment, and suddenly she is the one with the upper hand over her boss. But yeah, it's really good. It's mostly those two actors for the whole film. They've got really good chemistry together. It's got that Sam Raimi thing where there was a moment in the film where I thought, oh, this is going off in a different direction. And you go, no, it's not going in that direction because it's a Sam Raimi film. I know what direction it's definitely going to go in. But there's some really gross out moments that kind of lit the room in the best way in the cinema. So half the people are laughing and half the people are appalled. But yeah, it's really fun. I think obviously there'll be better films than this year, but I don't think there'll be any as fun as this. And it completely held my attention for the whole 2 hours. I didn't look at my watch once. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
I think okay. Yeah, that's when it is that kind of genre, he always does well. I think a few years ago he did Drag Me to Hell, when he returned to this after
Yeah.
20 years. But is this as good or better, Andrew? You saw this?
Yeah, it's very much in the tone of because to say horror, I mean it's kind of a mix of different genres. Like starts out more as sort of this dark comedy set in an office, and then things take a turn, and then becomes like a survival thriller, and then the horror-ish elements come later in the film. So it's really a mix of genres. It's not just one thing. And also, when the horror or that kind of stuff happens, it's kind of done from a Sam Raimi perspective. So people think horror, they think one thing. And then I remember when Drag Me to Hell came out. So some people who were horror films were kind of disappointed because they thought, oh, it was a little too campy or whatever. And then realized that that was a Sam Raimi film. And when Sam Raimi does horror, he adds a lot of camp, a lot of kind of, yeah, it's violent, but it's sort of like wink and smile type of thing. Like, not so much the first Evil Dead, but like Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness. And then again, years later with Drag Me to Hell. So, this is kind of in that tone, some of the more violent scenes. And they do happen. So, yeah, there's very much what James said about the dynamics of how the things have roles have switched, when they're on the island. Even before that, the scenes in the early part of the film where you're introduced to the characters, and particularly the character played by Rachel McAdams, character called Linda Little. That's sort of like an alliterative name. So you get into like the story in the office and how she does all this stuff for her employers and the company. And initially, the head of the company was going to give her this promotion, and then he passes away. His son, who's played by Dylan O'Brien, takes over, and he seems to take a have a different approach with regards to Rachel McAdams' character, and sort of like, yeah, I'm not really big on her. She looks funny and smells funny. She eats all these tuna sandwiches at her desk. So, and that's kind of like what things are established. Like the boss, the new boss, Dylan O'Brien's character is sort of like this, like he's got his bro friends from the fraternity days at university, and that kind of that dynamic kind of comes into play later on, and things get kind of switched on its head, and you sort of like say, I won't try to give away too much because there's stuff that happens during the film that you're kind of like, oh, okay. Yeah, and so there are stories that you think it's going to go one way and then it's not, and then you things you've maybe seen in other films like this, you think like, oh, okay, I can see where this is going, and maybe true, but there's other things going on. So yeah, I mean, I would say it's not just a horror film, it's a lot of different genres, as I said. So yeah, I generally liked it, and worth checking out.
Alfonso, you will enjoy this as well. A bit of a
Yeah,
fan, yeah.
I loved it. Like Marty Supreme before, I so loved it a lot. It was really, really fun, really twisty, Both actors were amazing. As James said, Rachel McAdams has a wonderful role that goes through iterations where before she's in the island and after she's in the island. You don't expect where the story is going. The stakes are going up and up all the time. You don't feel like it's just two characters because it's just, I mean, there are more characters in the film, but it's always very engrossing, always things moving, happening, danger and twists, and really well defined the characters and they what they want, and they often want the opposing things. Really, really, really a wonderful film too.
That's good. I also feel kind of in safe hands with Sam Raimi when he's kind of like quirky, dark material, and he was so you can like kind of pleased he's doing well as well. Next, it's sentimental value. This is more of a intimate family drama exploring intergenerational trauma, emotional inheritance. So it's quite heavy, you know, this one. A good anchored ensemble cast in this one. So Alfonso, you did see this. Is this who's in this, and what is it
Well,
about exactly?
Sentimental Value, it's a film about a director who is working on a new film and tries to cast his own daughter, who he has not been connected to for a little while, for a few years, I guess. And he tries to reconnect with her via casting her in her new film, but she refuses and he finds another actress, an American actress. And the movie that they are trying to do has to do also with the family history. It's a great film. Another film that I really loved. All the actors and actresses are fantastic. It tackles the history of a family through generations, embodied in the house that the film is going to take place in, and it's also the family house. And it's a Stellan Skarsgård is wonderful in the film. Elle Fanning is wonderful in the film. Joaquin Trier, who we knew from The Worst Person in the World, also with this actress, Renate Rizvi. It's like a cult director, I would say. Many people really like The Worst Person in the World, and I enjoyed that, but I enjoyed this one more. I thought is that the acting was fantastic, the script was fantastic as well, and it had a lot of sentimental value. So wonderful film, and also very nominated for Best Picture, very deservedly so.
His title in the running there. Okay, it's good one to look out for. Next, another biopic. This is more of a musical biopic following a married Neil Diamond and, well, a Neil Diamond tribute act. Starring, what, Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson? There's Blue Collar Dreamers, Mike and Claire. This came out in the UK quite early on, actually, in January, so it's kind of come and gone already here, but. Andrew, you saw this. Is it good? Is it something fresh in there? It's quite light-hearted material, but I don't know if it's someone chasing their dream. Is that kind of like the vibe I'm getting from this?
Well, the thing for me is, I had already seen the documentary that this is sort of a remake of, I guess you could say. The documentary, this is all based on a true story. These were real people. So there was a documentary about them that came out way back in 2008. I think that's where the director, Craig Brewer, got the idea from. So I think my issue is that with this film is that you see the documentary, and that's like the real people and the real story. In my comparison, this just seems a little bit more Hollywoodized. So, just to give you some background, the couple in the film, their names are Mike Sardinia and Claire Sardinia,
Claire,
or Claire Stengel, as she was known, but Mike and Clara Sardinia, or Sardina, sorry, M Mike and Clara Sardina. They, I guess, covered Neil Diamond songs, rather he was more into Neil Diamond than she was into other artists, but she kind of came to be into Neil Diamond through marrying Mike. So, and they would perform at different venues in the state of Wisconsin, like the Wisconsin State Fair and other local venues around there. So, and I guess one of the highlights of their musical career was getting a chance to perform with Pearl Jam back in the 90s. So, as I said, I already seen the documentary, and then watching, I think the documentary is maybe available on YouTube, so I don't know. That's worth checking out. I mean, I've seen it, so I guess my issue when you compare the two versions of the story is that the documentary is more grounded. It's more like this is them, and when I see the movie, it's kind of like, well, or this new film, it's kind of like, well, yeah, it's fine if you don't know anything else before and you're just introduced to this story for the first time, and you kind of get like, oh, okay, this is like great story, really, knowing about these people and their love of music. But seeing the documentary first, it's sort of like, yeah, this is more Hollywoodized, and like I Kate Hudson kind of looks like Clara Sardina, maybe, but Hugh Jackman just looks like Hugh Jackman to me. I mean, maybe he looks like Mike Sardina, but I don't know. That's just, and also the way that stuff is played out in the film. Just one other thing is that their act's name was Lightning and Thunder. So Lightning is Mike Sardina, and Thunder is Claire Sardina. So Lightning and Thunder, when their story gets covered in the documentary, certain things get introduced early on, and then those things get introduced later on in this version of the story. So I'm sorry I'm going off on all that, but as I said, if you don't know this story and you're just watching it for the first time and you're just watching these people play these versions of these real life personalities, and then you watch the new film, it's like, that's fine. You watch it, you enjoy it, you get their story, you get the basics, and it's maybe you feel a certain way coming out of the film. I just feel like having seen the documentary, you maybe should give that a chance. And it's not really the most uplifting story. I mean, you realize how tough it is, even the best of circumstances, to get into the music business. And especially with all the stuff that these two people go through, this couple that have a lot of health issues that the film, well, both films really touch on. But I don't know. I mean, as I said, I would probably feel differently if I hadn't seen the documentary first. I mean, I think this film is all right, but I guess I'm just more partial to the documentary since I've seen that first. So,
Sure. Okay. And that was Song Sung Blue, I think. I kind of forgot the title, but that's come and gone already, but that's it's probably on streaming somewhere. Right. Next, we move to a conspiracy thriller series where an FBI agents investigate a series of gruesome supermodel deaths and expose a global corporate plot. This has got Ashton Kutcher and Rebecca Hall. It seems like the premise is a lot like, sounds a bit like The Substance, from what I hear. But, this is on Amazon Prime? I'm not sure. But, Alfonso, you saw this where this is a series, right? So,
yeah,
where's this found on and is it good?
it is. Well, it is good enough. It is entertaining from beginning to, well, it's we are in the middle of the season more or less, so. But yeah, it's that basically there is let's say there is a cure for being your body getting older and everything, and so with this kind of thing that you can get in different ways, but it can also be sexually, like getting in bed with someone that has it, you can get it too. Well, with this you get younger and very much hotter, so but it has well, let's say secondary effects that are quite deathly too, so it's a also a mixed bag. So These two FBI agents are trying to discover what is happening, and there are other characters played by people like, yeah, like Ashton Kutcher throughout the film. Other interesting actors, by the way. Rebecca Hall, she does a great performance here. She, and then I wasn't expecting that she would turn such a great performance in. I mean, it's not like like something that she really sh made for her to shine, but I really thought that she was really giving her best to this, let's say, fun, entertaining series that doesn't try to be a thing with much depth. But yeah, it's just like a twisted thriller with hot people going around Italy and in New York and different places, and it has a tongue. It's very tongue in cheek too. Like people know that nobody takes it very seriously. This kind of thriller with models or mo not models, but everyone can be have the anyone can have the body of a model. In reality, it's well, yeah. But the thing is that yeah, it's like a let's say like a cure for being decrepit little by life, but it's in the testing phase, let's say. Anyway, it's fun.
Fine. Okay. Right. A skin deep thriller, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. Next. A crime thriller movie with some favorite two buddy actors, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, starring as a couple of Miami cops who whose unity unravels when they, I guess, find millions in a warehouse, and then I think they have to safeguard it and then see if their loyalty to the force or themselves win out. I think that's the premise, is kind of a one-line premise on that, but good cast. Is it a good movie? It's Andrew Richard, you saw this as well. Looks like
It was okay. It was actually better than I thought. Doesn't mean that it was great. So yeah, kind of in the middle. I don't know why actually I watched this movie in the first place. I think I was tired, so I didn't want to go out. So I said, okay, what's on Netflix? And I saw this thing. Obviously, when you have a movie starring both Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, that's kind of in a way interesting. It's definitely different from Will Hunting, I can tell you that. It's what it's about. How to sum up the synopsis like you did, without going to spoilers. So Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are working in some police departments, kind of a DEA, kind of a DEA, but anyway, among other things, they are working to fight drug traffic, and one of their colleagues is killed. Prologue of the movie, huh? So no spoilers. She's killed straight away, and obviously it kind of shook them both up. It's kind of shocking for them and for all the colleagues. It's like a group of cops. But they are all shaken by this death of this colleague. And I think, if I understand correctly, this colleague, just before she died, kind of was working on some kind of big case. And Matt Damon, who is kind of the boss, decides to follow this case as well and try actually to crack this case as well, and their path gets them all towards a house where there is a lot of money, like more than they thought, and things gets worse by the minute from the moment they enter that house. I'm trying to actually to avoid spoilers again because there are some twists in this movie, but actually I didn't see coming, which is cool. That's the good thing about this thing, but I thought we just dumb action movie from start to finish, and however, not so much. They were actually kind of yeah twists, interesting. You have a supporting role by the guy from The Wolf of Wall Street. Is it Dave Chandler or something like that. What's his name? Kyle Chandler, sorry. And we're talking about The Walking Dead. There's also Steven Yeun in this movie. So yeah, no, it was as it's better than I thought. It's not too long for what it is. Again, it's definitely not worth any Oscar, but it was a good movie to watch on Netflix. Talking about what is a good Netflix movie, that's a good Netflix movie. Not a movie that should be released in movie theaters, but a good streaming movie.
It did look like it was one of those Netflix movies which you had during the old COVID where they're releasing
Exactly.
big budget movies and thinking it belonged to that kind of thing. I was like,
Yeah.
good production values, but not quite good enough to be in a cinema. But anyway, Andrew, you saw this as well. Punching above its weight, was it? Or did you
Yeah.
like this? Or...
Yeah, it's entertaining, I guess that's one way to put it. It's a crime thriller, maybe action a little bit film. And yeah, just to add on what Richard already said, it has a decent cast, in addition to the ones that have already been mentioned. You have Teyana Taylor, who's in it. People are talking about her maybe winning possibly this year for one battle after another. So she's part of the cast of this film. Also, Sasha Calle, Catalina Sandino Moreno, she's in the film. And some of the other ones you mentioned. Yeah, it's entertaining. Does also give context. From what I understand, the title of The Rip refers to the stash of cash that they find. It's like a they basically the action in the film, without trying to give too much away, takes place at a stash house, or a house where this drug cartel has stashed away some money. And so a lot of what happens in the film is sort of like trying to figure out what the characters are going to do or what they're not going to do in regards to finding out about this money. And then you also have the opening part of the film where that other police officer gets murdered, the police captain gets murdered. So trying to figure out who killed her. So there's kind of like a murder mystery kind of aspect of the film, sort of trying to figure out how. What happened to her and why did she get killed and who killed her and how that ties into what happens through the rest of the film with regards to the rip of the film's title. So yeah, it's an entertaining film. I mean, again, I'm going back to what Richard said about whether it's something that would have been worthy to be released in cinemas, I don't know, but yeah, for something on Netflix, yeah, it's fine. There's probably better films of this genre out there, maybe, I imagine. But yeah, this is fine. It's a fine film.
Well, from one hard-hitting cop drama to another, it's
Yeah,
animated a buddy cop sequel, Zootopia 2. The only difference is this has made humongous amounts of money
it's true.
in the box office this year, and it's a sequel. It's the animated sequel where Judy and Nick investigate missing reptiles and a tech cover-up. Oh, very, very dark business here, which could reshape the city. Going for Goodwin and Jason Bateman return. This must be phenomenal because I haven't even watched the first one, but the amount of box office this has made must be hard-hitting stuff. James, you saw Zootopia 2 and you're muted again.
And you mute again.
So maybe
You
we'll
mute
go to.
again. You mute again.
I saw Zootropolis 2, as it's called in the
Oh,
UK,
sorry.
because
Oh,
when
yes. I have a
Zootopia.
question. Why? Why it's
Because
called? Why it's called
in
the
2016, when Zootopia was due to open, there was a company called Zootopia that was registered on Companies House in the UK, and there was a zoo meant to open up called Zootopia, right? And Disney were like, well, we can't, they were there first, so we can't tell them not to do that, but we don't want them to, so we're going to rename it. The zoo never opened. But in the UK, the whole of the first film is redubbed with the word Zootropolis instead of Zootopia. So fast forward to 10 years later, they've done the same thing for Zootropolis 2 or Zootopia 2. Following Hobbs and Wild again. And I really love the first one. You've got to watch it, Richard, because it's
Yeah,
just
no. I love. Although I
Oh,
watched,
no, sorry, not Richard Jason. Sorry,
I
Jason's
watched
haven't
three
been
times
this
the
year.
first one. I enjoyed it.
Because my question is, how has this made so much money, and is it that
I have
elite?
no idea. I have no
So,
idea why the second
well,
one made almost $2 billion. I have no
a
idea.
lot of it, so.
Let's go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first one is, it's really good, and it's got
No, yeah.
really good characters, and it's basically about them becoming partners, sort of cop partners, so that the rabbit and the fox, so it's a nice little story. And you've got these wonderful, really big voice cast in it. Idris Elba's in it, who is obviously instantly recognizable. Shakira, lots of in jokes of people voicing animals that are close to their namesake and things like that. And you also have Flash, the sloth, because I wondered why I watched this film, and it's because of the sequence where they're talking to Flash the sloth, who reacts very slowly to everything that's said. And it's hilarious, right? And my big gripe about this new film is Flash is barely in it. He
Exactly.
like he almost needs his own spin-off, and I think I would watch that even with the pauses. I think it would be hilarious. Don't get me wrong, it was really fun to be back in this world. It really was. But I feel it's lacking, the story just isn't as good as the first one. So it's kind of like, oh, what comes next? Sod it. I'm just going to drop it in. RoboCop. We talk about RoboCop. I wasn't planning to do this, right? But with RoboCop, we always say maybe the original story, the origin story, is the best thing. And then that they do the TV series and it's just other cases, other cases. And like with this, it's about that initial meeting and the stuff. And there is stuff here about their partnership, and that's fun, but it's all been explored in the previous one. And I don't know how much it would have just been fun to revisit the first film. Obviously, now this has taken, I mean, the original was a budget of 150 million, and it made over a billion in the time when everything made a billion. But now this has made close to 2 billion. It's the second biggest box office film of last year, apart from Czar 2. So it's the biggest Hollywood film, and it's significantly bigger than box office than Avatar 3, which has got a sting a little bit, the people that assume that that would walk 2 billion. But it's done really well in China, I think, as well. The other thing that happened with Moana 2, because that was one that they were going to put to stream in, actually having that gap, a really big gap between sequels, is often a good thing for the box office, because there's a bunch of kids who never saw the first one in the cinema. Or if you're six, it didn't even exist. Do you know what I mean? Like, you couldn't have gone back in time and seen it when you were minus four. So you watch this at home on streaming, and suddenly, wow, there's a new Zootropolis or Zootopia film. And so you go and see it at the cinema. It is good, and it is good. It's fine, but I don't think it's of the caliber of the first one. And it's
Absolutely.
just the originality. I'm always a little bit like, what can you do that you bring that's new to the table, but it's really enjoyable. It's done very well. And also the probably the idea of releasing it at Christmas is quite a shrewd move, because people will go and see it if they're
Which
looking for
like
something that's family friendly. Even when you've got, this year you're going to have a Dunes Day, as it's being called. There is still that thing of, you might not take very young children to see this, but this is suitable for all the family. So yeah, it's really fun. Obviously, because it's now made near to 2 billion, and it'll probably cross 2 billion. It's not slowing down, actually. Maybe it, I'm sure Zootopia 3, we won't be waiting another 10 years for the next one. I'm sure the next one will be coming very, very soon.
Okay, and all right. Okay, and just any, we'll go around a couple of special recommendations. James, you've got one for us. H for Hawk, what's that exactly?
Yeah, H for Hawk, yeah, based on a true story, and it's a lady who's she works at a university. Her father dies, and she father played by Brendan Gleeson, and the character played by Claire Foy. And after Brendan Gleeson's character dies, she feels very cut off, for sort of very isolated from the rest of her family. She doesn't really breathe, sort of maybe in the traditional way, and she's struggling to sort of open up. And she decides to adopt a goshawk, which is one of the most difficult birds to train, by all accounts. And it's a very nuanced performance by Claire Foy. It's really, really stunning performance, I think. And it's very different to the depiction of grief by Jesse Buckley in Hamnet, but I think it's maybe more believable. I think the Claire Foy one, it's sort of a more restrained performance, but I think it's maybe how people more often react. and it's in a very short time frame. But there's a real goshawk in it, and there's scenes that are sort of real scenes of the goshawk hunting and things like that. It's only like 100 minutes, but it's a really good little film, I think. So H for Hawk.
Okay, thanks. And Richard, you've got a couple of recommendations.
Two mentions. The first one is an animated movie. So it's a French animated movie that had literally a critical acclaim, I think. Anyway, it has been released. I think it was released first in the festival of Annecy in France, that is celebrating actually animated movies. And then it went abroad and it gets even nominated at the Oscars. So Amélie et la métaphysique des tubes in French, it was released abroad as Little Amélie of the character of Rain. It is an adaptation, loosely adapted from a book by Amélie Nothomb, who is a very famous French, no, sorry, writer from Belgium, who is famous in France, sorry, extremely popular in France, perhaps the most popular female writer of the last 50 years in France. Every single one of her book is like a bestseller, and Métaphysique des tubes is one of her most popular one. And it tells, let's say, that it in a very funny way, a childish way, he tells her own story of Amélie Nothomb, how she grew up in Japan. Because actually, it's true that actually Amélie Nothomb grew up in Japan. She's actually the daughter of a Belgian diplomat who lived in Japan, and it kind of is. She's a very smart writer, and you can see it. The animated movie of a book by Amélie Nothomb is this extremely good idea. Actually, it's surprising that nobody had thought about that in France before, because she's has great imagination. Because she's able to talk about serious stuff and also very simple stuff, but with her own words and her own images, own imagination. And it's always funny to read. She did everything from, I said, from kind of biopic to thrillers, etc. And in that case, it's kind of a biopic, but it's a funny biopic. It's Amélie, who is like 3 years old, and she tried to understand the world around her. It's extremely funny, extremely sad sometimes. And the animation is pretty amazing. I don't think it will win the Oscar, unfortunately, because in this category there are some very strong contenders, and very popular ones, more popular than Amélie. But anyway, it's always good actually to have some recognition. And the second one is kind of a French movie, but with an international cast. Another French movie called Le Mage du Kremlin, or The Wizard of the Kremlin. Another adaptation from a book. It's directed by Olivier Azayas, but it has, as I said, an international cast with, to name a few, Paul Dano, Jude Law, and Jeffrey Wright, to name a few, as I said. And again, so there is a disclaimer at the beginning of the movie, a very important disclaimer, especially nowadays. I'm guessing that it was almost dangerous to release a movie like this. Because let's say, how can I describe in a few words? If you remember The Apprentice, the movie about Donald Trump a couple of years back, in a way, The Wizard of the Kremlin is The Apprentice, but for Vladimir Putin. And it's through the eyes of a fictional character who perhaps existed, but not with his name, a fictional character, fictional guy who actually was a student who rose to prominence in Moscow, and who became, one way or another, he became a very powerful guy, head of the first TV channel of Russia just before the fall of the USSR, and who became, straight after that, let's say, the first political advisor of a very important guy who will become the leader of Russia, Vladimir Putin, played by Jude Law. So Paul Dano is playing the advisor, and Jude Law is playing Vladimir Putin. I will not talk much about the performance of Jude Law because he's literally mimicking Vladimir Putin most of the time. So that's not the strength of the movie. The strength of the movie is how it's written, because obviously every single time you think Is it true? Is not true? Is it true? Is not true? Obviously, I'm guessing that the writer would say that nothing is true and he imagined everything, but they are a lot they play with this because there are a lot of real footage in between the movie among fictional scenes. So yeah, the line between reality and fiction is very, very thin, and I think it's worth watching it. Again, not a good idea to think that everything is true, to take everything for granted, but still, I think it's an interesting analysis of what happened in Russia and in Europe for the last, what, 25 years, even more, 35 years. It has some humor, but also some moments that make you think. So, yeah, I really, really enjoyed this movie, to be honest. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks for that, Richard. And thanks to our hosts. Thank you for joining me, James, Andrew, Alfonso, and of course, Richard. And we'll see you next time. Thank you, guys.
We hope you enjoyed this film and TVReview.com episode. Catch the latest film and TV reviews, together with regular episode content from the world of film and TV every week. See you soon. Would you like to reach our film and TV review podcast audience? Do you have a product or service of interest to film and TV home consumers or followers of the entertainment industry? Have a film or show production to publicize? For affordable price plans for all budgets, get in touch and find out about our introductory advertising options. Reach our audience of film and TV viewers and visit our site contact page at filmandtvreview.com, or you can email us at business@filmandtvreview.com. Reach out today.